Let's start this hour at home, where, as you can hear, the election result is nigh. The ABC election analyst Anthony Green says Malcolm Turnbull will stay as Prime Minister in a minority government or with the thinnest of majorities. But this tight result surely shows how the political landscape has changed. Many voters make it clear that they don't like or they don't understand what the main parties stand for. Malcolm Turnbull's message of innovation and agility, excitement, these were to many voters meaningless buzzwords. This is the sort of language of McKinsey's and the world of management consulting. Labor did hit the mark with very concrete language about Medicare and penalty rates, but its 35.5%, I think, was still one of the lowest votes on record. The social researcher, Dr. Rebecca Huntley, has spent a decade interrogating Australians about their attitude. She's a very perceptive understander of Australian thinking. Rebecca was until recently head of Ipsos. Rebecca, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Andrew, it's lovely to talk to you.
Rebecca, I wasn't surprised, by the way, at the strong emphasis that Labor placed on Medicare, because I heard you speak earlier this year. Tell me the story of the focus group where people explained what they thought were unique Australian values.
Yeah, look, it wasn't even just one focus group. It was groups across the spectrum, regardless of gender, to some extent, regardless of generation as well. It was a study on the nature of Australian identity. And, you know, Australians are broadly a pretty clever bunch, probably cleverer than lots of people in the media and politics assume. But it was really interesting to listen to them talk about Australian identity. So they kind of went through all the normal attributes, that are kind of the cliches that people ascribe to Australian identity. So they went through them and said, well, you know, egalitarianism is not something that we've invented necessarily. The fair go, the whole idea of mateship, I think they are friendships in other countries. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are other countries that love sport as much as us and a lot more, and there are countries that drink more than we do. but when they boil down to it, they said there are only really two things that you can say are uniquely Australian: koalas and Medicare. And I thought that was, it was funny, and it was something that a lot of groups arrived at. But to me, it showed the importance of something like Medicare becomes a kind of a symbol for most people. I mean, they're not necessarily averse to changes to Medicare that will make sure that Medicare continues for generations in the future. But the whole idea that we would have to move to an American system where you have to be wealthy or employed to afford decent healthcare seems un-Australian, to use a phrase a term I don't normally like to use, but that was certainly what they arrived at.
And that finding obviously found its way very much into the Labor Party thinking during this election campaign. So but Medicare, it says something more about Australia's attitude to what, fairness or to justice or something?
It does. It does also reflects to their growing concern about the issue of health. And that's a broader discussion, recognising that society is ageing, that we have some lifestyle-associated diseases. If we're all supposed to be agile and innovative into our early 70s, we better have a healthcare system that supports it. So it reflected a number of things, and it wasn't just a sense that people want to have the government do everything for us. I think what's clear is that the electorate realises that as we move towards an important kind of, you know, budget repair, and we do need to kind of scrutinise what the government can and can't do, we do need to pick winners. So for some voters, it did boil down to, do I want the government to give business tax cuts, or do I want them to continue to invest in Medicare? And for some people, it was a very clear distinction. And I think it's one of the reasons, along with the fact that in this election we didn't get a lot about asylum seekers and border protection, I think it's one of the reasons why the Labor Party won back parts of Western Sydney, for example.
Rebecca, that language about the $50 billion tax cut for business, I think there was also a very, let us say, finely honed line in there about $7 or $9 billion going to the big banks. How did that feed also Australia's skepticism, as it were, about big business and, you know, complete untrammelled free markets, especially the banks?
Yeah, there's a little bit. There's certainly a bit of that. I wouldn't want to overstate it. But I think the thing that's been quite interesting is the government have been reasonably successful at convincing the electorate that we do need to be responsible with government spending. And so in the end, if they said, well, if the government can't continue to spend and also can't continue to dole out, you know, middle-class welfare and so forth, well, what are they going to do? Who are they going to give money to or help and support? So when it looks like they're singling out business, and I think there's also, we have to add to this, and you would understand this, Andrew, a bit of a scepticism about whether tax breaks to business always lead to investment into new workers. So there is this sense of, well, if you actually do this, if you actually support business in this way, will it mean that my son, who, you know, lives in, you know, rural New South Wales or lives in South Australia, will actually be better off getting a job than worse off? So there is that scepticism, I suppose, about trickle-down economics.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of time, Rebecca, but when I kept hearing this language of agility and of innovation and the most exciting time to be alive, I recall Paul Keating's mantra as he was going up to that devastating loss in 96, where he kept talking about APEC, Mabo and the Republic. And I remember at the time, and I was, you know, just in my early 20s, but Labor people saying, there goes another 10,000 votes. This sort of language, it lacks anything that's concrete. It's the language of McKinsey's, and I'm not sure how well that resonates.
No, you've got to make it concrete for people, and especially when people are really super anxious about the future and the future of an Australia post-mining boom. So unless you say, and therefore, you know, this is exciting and agile times and all the rest of it, and this is what we're going to do. And unless you make that concrete for people, particularly in states like South Australia and Tasmania, where unemployment and the issue of employment is the number one concern, and we know that there are real issues in terms of big parts of the community either trying to secure work or worried about their kids, then that language does seem a bit empty.
Just very briefly, you have always warned political parties not to misunderstand, for example, the Hansen phenomena, because part of it, yes, is a grievance based on immigration or even race, but there's a deeper grievance that goes to economics there. I think Margot Kingston, who wrote the book on Pauline Hansen, reminded us of that in the past week. But what did you find about the appeal of Pauline Hansen on the non-racial questions?
I think there is, in the kind of vacuum of the ability of major parties to talk about the kinds of transitions that we're going through as a society and economy, then people do gravitate towards easy solutions. And one of those easy solutions is, oh, just close the borders, no new immigrants. And as well, if you just talk primarily in the language of economics and not in the language of values and the issues around social cohesion, if you're just talking about new migrants means more money and more jobs, Australians aren't entirely focused on the economy. As Eva Cox always says, we live in a society as much as an economy. And so she does really connect. And part of her appeal is that she's not political, and there's a lot of, you know, global appeal of anti-politicians. So it is really not as simple as saying these people are racist. It's not as simple as saying they're not either. It is, I find, a real diversity in the kinds of people that vote or like Pauline Hanson or see that she has a point.
Yeah. So it's not just disaffected conservatives, as the Liberal Senator Corey Bernardi claims.
It could be disaffected Labor voters. It could be people that are real swingers. There is not a direct translation of the Hanson vote to the Liberal Party. That is a completely simplistic analysis.
Yeah. Just finally, Rebecca, where were people getting their information in this election from? Because they blithely ignored not just the editorial endorsements, but, you know, quite frankly, the rigorous editorial campaigning of certain newspapers, especially in Western Sydney. That had no effect at all.
Yeah, look, where people are getting their political information now is really fractured. It really depends on generation, how connected you are to the internet and how much you care. I am fascinated, and there is something to study the long-term implications of the rise in the pre-poll and where people who might vote 2 or 3 weeks before an election, where they're getting their information and whether they continue to connect with political information after they vote and whether that change their views. So it's absolutely clear that the newspapers don't have the power that they used to, which is perhaps why they're shouting louder than they ever have before.
Well, yes, crying into the wilderness, Rebecca. Rebecca.
That's your phrase, not mine.
Rebecca Huntley, social researcher and writer. Thank you very much for being with us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you,
Rebecca.
Andrew. Thank
Pleasure.
You.
Pleasure. Now, stay with us. Our government theme so far this morning, why do minority governments get such a bad rap here in Australia?